Hey, everybody, this is Ricky Warwick, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast. Oh, yeah.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me today in the Zoom room, it's his third time here. We have never had a guest here three times. We've had a couple people here twice, but never three times. So I'm very excited, as always, to welcome Ricky Warwick. How you doing, Ricky?
Hi, Pat. How you doing? Thanks for having me on. I'm honored. Thank you. That's a hat trick of appearances.
Yeah, well, and every time you're here, the music that you're promoting is stellar. So once again, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but your new album that's coming out February 19th, When Life Was Hard and Fast, is terrific. It's right.
Thank you.
It's right in the wheelhouse of what you do currently. And when I say that, because it's not like the Almighty. Mm-hmm. There's elements of Black Star Riders in here, of course, because
that's what your
current thing is. But this is a solo record. This is your seventh proper solo album. So congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah. So, no, I'm very proud of it.
And again, released through Nuclear Blast Records. It's going to be on vinyl. It's going to be a single CD. It's going to be a double CD. So excellent. First question. Was this written and recorded during the lockdown?
It was not. No,
it was not.
The album was written. It was not. No, the album was written in 2018. And recorded in April of 2019. So, you know, almost 8-9 months prior to the pandemic hitting us.
Okay, so this was written before the last Black Star Riders album.
It was kind of written at the same time as the last Black Star Riders album. So 2018 was the bulk of the writing and when the demoing for this record was done. Yep.
And then recording it, you guys did it in person because it was pre-pandemic.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Now, here's a question. When you're in a band, but then you're doing a solo album, how do you decide, well, I'm keeping this song for me, or I want to work on this one with the guys in the band?
I don't know. I instinctively know, I think, what's going to work for Black Star Riders and what's going to work for Ricky Warwick. There's limitations with Black Star Riders, which are good limitations, in that we have a style and a sound that people expect and we want to sort of adhere to. Also, when I'm writing something for Black Star Riders, I'm very aware of what Scott Gorham, Christian, you know, Chad and Robbie are going to bring to that song.
Right.
You know, I know that they're going to get involved and they're going to make their mark on it. And that's great. That's the way that I want it. So that's very conscious in the back of my mind. You know, when I'm writing for myself, all bets are off. The road's wide open. I can go anywhere with it. I can do anything I want with it. And, you know, nobody's going to question it except me. And, you know, that's good. It appeals to the narcissistic side of me. Look, I love to write, Pat, and I write continuously. I write all the time. I'm never sort of going, well, I got to write for a solo record. Well, I got to write for a Black Star writer. I just write.
Yeah.
And then it's a question of going through, going, well, you know, that's probably going to work pretty good, you know, as a Ricky Warwick song. I think, you know, Scott or Christian get their hands on this. This is going to be an amazing Black Star Riders song. You just kind of know. It's funny because, I play the solo stuff. And there's been a couple of times where I played him to Scott Gorham. And Scott does this great thing with his left eyebrow where he kind of looks at you and goes, and the eyebrow goes up. And I went, he goes, that could be one of ours, bud. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, maybe it could, you know. But I think the thing is, he understands that I'm not selling anybody short.
Right.
It's not like I'm turning up for Black Star Riders and don't have the songs because I've used them all in my solo stuff.
Right, right.
You know, and Scott trusts me and understands that I'm always going to turn up armed with plenty of material for Black Star Riders. So nobody's really losing out in the whole deal, which is cool.
And sadly, the release of the last Black Star Riders album, you didn't really get to properly promote it the way you guys were scheduled to or had hoped to. And
No, yeah, we get hammered. You know, we put it out end of September 2019, hit the road in earnest in October that year. Got 7 great weeks in the UK and Europe. And 2020 last year was a Black Star Riders year. We were playing on some shows in the States, you know, South America, Asia, all the European festivals. That was our plan. You know, there was over 100 shows in the pipeline, and you know, sadly, yeah, that was it.
And a shout out to that album called Another State of Grace. If you like the songs you hear today on this show, go back and listen to Black Star Riders, because you're going to like that stuff too. But that's a great album. And I've told you before,
thank you.
Every Black Star Riders album gets better, and that's hard to do.
Difficult
to do. So,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's start with, I want to talk about the album cover of When Life Was Hard and Fast, because if I'm going old school, if I was a kid and I was going to a record store and I hadn't heard this album, the first thing I would see would be that album cover. So tell us a little bit about the album cover, because I know there's a story to it.
It's a great album cover. And, you know, I'm saying that with all humility. It really is something special. It depicts a scene from a motor car race in the early 1930s. And the scene is, I'll explain it better. From about 1928 to about 1936, there was a motor race in Ireland. And it was called the Ards TT. And the town of Newton Ards is abbreviated as Ards. It's where I'm from. It's where I was born. It's where I grew up. And I grew up on a farm there. And my dad would tell me about this race that used to happen when he was a little boy. And I kind of became fascinated with it. And, you know, you're talking 300,000-400,000 spectators would come and watch this race from all over the world, from all over Ireland. And these guys were the NASCAR Formula One drivers of their day, driving these primitive automobiles that they had back in the 20s and 30s, fraught with danger, fraught with throws and spills, and sadly quite a few deaths as well.
Because they were converted, they were convertibles, right? They didn't have a top, did they?
Nothing. I mean, no health and safety. And those guys were wearing the old leather helmets and the goggles.
Right.
And it was a road race. So they're not racing on a prefabricated racing circuit. They're racing on roads.
Yeah.
So obviously, this, you know, you're talking 20s and 30s. Probably the quality of the roads, surfaces weren't that great. Oh, no. Potholes everywhere, all that kind of shit. And I just became fascinated with this race as the Ards TT. And that picture on the front cover is actually a crash scene in front of a whole bank of spectators. The bank of spectators is my grandfather's field from his farm that he used to rent out every year to the spectators to watch the race. And the crash scene is right in front of that field. And it just tied in with the whole album title, When Life Was Hard and Fast, the song, the whole imagery. I've been waiting to use it for a long, long time, because it's something that I'm very interested in, obviously. And it all just aligned for this record. And we're actually working on a TV documentary about the race.
Oh, nice.
So I'm hoping that's going to come to fruition, and that'll get commissioned hopefully pretty soon.
And then would the songs from this album serve as kind of a soundtrack for that documentary?
I mean, I think specifically Life when Life Was Hard and Fast is maybe tied to that song. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are obviously about different subjects and different things. But it had a personal connection to me, a personal family connection to me. You know, obviously for obvious reasons, and it just all seemed to knit together really well.
Perfect. And there's other family connections that we'll talk about as we move along with each song. But I want to ask you about the band that plays on this album. Now you did steal Robbie Crane from Black Star Riders, because you've said before he's your favorite bass player
in the whole world.
So he's on the record, and who else is on the record with you guys?
So the main core of the band that we put the actual backing tracks down with was Robbie Crane on bass, Xavier Muriel, ex-Buck Cherry on drums.
Okay.
For every track but Gunslinger, my manager, Adam Parsons, actually played drums on the Gunslinger track.
Okay.
And then myself and Keith on guitars, and obviously myself singing. Now, that was the band that we put the backing tracks down with when, you know, which we did in, I think, 2 days. It was very quick. You know, once they left, the bulk of the album was just me and Keith in the studio.
And that's Keith Nelson
working on it. Keith Nelson, people who will know X-Buck Cherry.
And he produced the album, or was it co-production with both of you?
It was co-produced, co-written and co-produced with Keith.
Okay, excellent. And recorded at your house or in a proper studio?
Proper studio. a studio called Stag Street in North Hollywood, and we did the backing tracks in there. And then we went over to Keith's, got his own place, his own studio, and we did all the overdubs and vocals in Keith's studio. So all done in studios, all done right here in Los Angeles.
I'm always impressed how technology has progressed, because you know, back in the day, records are made in you know, in huge studios over months and months, and you guys just get a great sounding records, you know, in studios. But you know what I mean. It's a little, I don't want to say lo-fi. You know what I mean. You can almost make a record anywhere now.
Well, nothing's really changed for me. I still record the same way I always have. Obviously, we're not recording on the tape,
right?
That's the digital side of it. But the writing process, the demoing process, and having your shit together, it hasn't changed. It's still very much the way I like to record, and I haven't really deviated from that too much, Pat. It's all about doing your homework. And because no matter how good technology gets and is getting, you can never replace the human emotion and human soul. You just never will. You never will. And so that's why very much I like to put the backing tracks down as a band when we're all together looking at each other in a studio. Of course we use Pro Tools. Of course we use technology for editing and to cut all those corners that you couldn't do 30 years ago. But that's it. That's it. It's not like... we're using plugins and auto tunes and all that kind of stuff. We use it to save labor intensive stuff like doing edits, or editing drum takes together or guitar parts. That's the beauty of it to me. Everything else is organic.
And I would assume if you start with a good demo, a good song, and then a good demo, a lot of the work's done.
We'll get into it as we go through the record, but there's a couple of tracks on the album that are demos.
Yeah.
We couldn't better. It's all about preparation. It's a good song. The song starts on an acoustic guitar, and it starts on the acoustic guitar with whether it's the riff or the melody or the vocal or whatever, but it starts and is finished on the acoustic guitar before it goes anywhere else.
Cool.
So I could sit and play you any of those songs that are on the record the whole way through on acoustic guitar, and it would sound fine. And then it starts to get really good when you start getting everybody else involved.
Now, speaking of that, you've been doing during lockdown, you've been doing some concerts from your house.
Yep.
And those have been selling out. And these are you on acoustic guitar.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing before I got in Thin Lizzy and Black Star Riders. I was out there touring like crazy, just me and the guitar all over the world. So I'm lucky I'm able to do that. And I'm lucky due to the lockdown that I'm able to sit in front of a computer and just play. It comes naturally to me. I've been using a platform called StageIt, which I really like because they treat it as much as a live show as you can. And that you buy a ticket, there's top supporter incentives. It's not like just turning on Facebook Live and standing there and going, here's my tip jar. And
right.
But then there's nothing wrong with that. I wanted to be more of an event. So I make posters and I put up flyers. I rehearse like it's a real show. I get focused in on it.
Right.
It gives me something to look forward to every month. And it's been really, really successful. And people go, well, how can an online show sell out? You're so, like it can't sell out. I could sell 10,000 tickets for that show, but it's about creating a demand.
Yes.
So you limit the amount of tickets that you get. And we're the same, I must go and buy a ticket for that, a football game. Remind me to get a ticket for that football game. You get it the day before. Oh, I need to go get a ticket for that concert.
Yeah.
You get it 2 days. That's human nature.
Yeah.
So I know. So if I keep creating a demand, go, there's only 10 tickets left. I know that I'm going to sell more tickets for my show.
Right.
And I know that it's going to be a better show because there's going to be a lot more people there. If I put, there's 20,000 tickets available, people, I'm in no rush to buy it. Oh, I forgot to get a ticket for that show. That's a shame.
And then when it sells out, then those people who missed it last time will definitely be on it next time.
They're the first in line. Every show, my numbers have grown.
Perfect.
And that's due to the create. It's about creating demand. I've been doing this a long time. And people, I missed out on getting a ticket. How can I? Sorry, they've been on sale for 5 weeks.
I know. What do you want? So when this album officially drops, will you be doing a show to promote the album?
Yeah, I think because obviously it doesn't look like we're going to get back out there anytime soon. Certainly not, probably not this year, sadly. we're talking about trying to put together a full band show, which because of restrictions that are in place in LA right now, we actually wanted to do it the week the album came out, but that's just not going to happen because we're still obviously very much in lockdown mode here. So hopefully we're looking at maybe possibly doing it in April.
All right, cool.
But the plan is to do a full album in its entirety with a full band.
And where would you stage that? Could you do that at home, or would you have to rent a location?
No, I think we'd probably go back to Stag Street Studios where we recorded the album.
Perfect, that makes sense.
I just do it in there, but obviously, you know, we can't all get together in the studio at the minute, so that's what's that's what the holdup is.
Gotcha. All right, let's get into it. The first track, When Life Was Hard. This is co-written with a guy named Sam Robinson. Who is Sam Robinson?
Sam Robinson is a very, very old friend of mine. We're both from East Belfast in Northern Ireland. He's my brother from another mother. People may have heard his name if you think his name sounds familiar. He co-wrote most of When Patsy Cline Was Crazy, my previous solo album with me. Sam is a great writer. He has a couple of books published, a great historian, a very knowledgeable man. Great stories, and we're just we grew up together in East Belfast, and Sam, we were talking about the race. You know, I'll talk to Sam once, twice a week, and usually what will happen, we'll be talking about something, and then usually a couple of days later, some lyrics will land in my inbox, and Sam's lyrics are they're amazing, they're stunning. He just has such a great way with words of graphically describing imagery, which I love. And he sent me through, we've been talking about being kids and pre-internet and pre-cell phones and getting thrown out of the house when the sun came up and playing in the streets and getting dirty and getting our knees cut and getting in fights and then coming in at you know, for your dinner at 7 o'clock and there was nobody checking up on you. And
right,
it's a different world, you know. And we were just on our dreams and our hopes and our aspirations about how, you know, we were in bands when we were at school, you know, just to try and get the girls to like us, or, you know, or we were good at soccer, all that, just being kids in Northern Ireland, what it was like for us. And I was talking about that race and the memories of that my dad would tell me. And lo and behold, 3 days after a conversation, the lyrics dropped through into my inbox. And I looked at the title and I just said, that's the title of the album.
Perfect.
Before I'd written anything else, I went, that's the title of the album right there. And literally, I wrote the music pretty quickly for it. Took it into Keith, and Keith was great. And that he said it's great. He said there's too much going on in it. And I said, what do you mean? He said there's a great story there. He said, but it's over elaborate. And we simplified it. And then Keith put in a great, friend of the music out there, he put in a great diminished seventh chord, which is a bit of an old Thin Lizzy trick. There's a great one in The Boys Are Back in Town. And Keith put this chord in the verse that just, to me, changed the whole dynamic of the song. And I also went back to Sam. I made a couple of little lyrical edits in his lyrics. And I said, is this cool? You know, because phonetically, and I just want to streamline this so that somebody that lives in Boise, Idaho, will listen to this and connect with it. It was a little bit too... You need to be from Belfast to get some of the colloquialisms, you know, that were in the lyrics.
Right.
And Sam's like, no, absolutely. And we reworked it. And probably the song, to be honest with you, we spent the most time on the record because of the potential of what it was going to be.
Yeah.
I think we all realized that, myself, Sam and Keith, and we spent a lot of time critiquing it and editing and working on the chords and the melody and the structure of the song. And then we demoed it and it sounded great. And as always, I use Joe Elliott as a sounding board for pretty much everything I do. Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, because you can't really argue with a guy that sold 150 million records, right?
No, you cannot.
So I sent it over to Joe, as I always do. Well, what do you think of this? Because Joe always tells me the truth, you know? And I love that. And I don't always agree with him, but at least I know I'm getting an honest answer.
Right.
He goes, this is great. He goes, this is really good. He goes, you want me to sing on it? And I was like, yeah. So, you know, 2 days later, it comes back with Joe's amazing backing vocals on it, and just great.
So when Joe Elliott sings background vocals on this, he records those at his house and sends them to you?
He does, yeah. That's where technology is great, yeah, these days. And yeah, it really kicks in because obviously, again, geography's against this. So we will send him, you know, the files. Joe has a studio at his house. He does his part straight back. It's great.
Now, Sam, is he's still in Belfast or is he in the States now?
No, Sam's very much still in Belfast.
Okay, so yeah. This was written, worlds apart. You two wrote this together.
Worlds apart. Yeah, worlds apart with a lot of common ground, you know, there as well.
and Joe, I don't, is he in the States or is he in Ireland?
Joe has many different houses.
Many different houses because of those, because of that record sales.
Many different abodes, rightly so, yes, as you would expect. His main place of residence is in Dublin in Ireland.
All right. That's what I thought.
Yeah,
all right.
Yep.
So if I can, I don't know if I can say this or not. And if I'm not allowed to say this, you can, I'll edit it out. But, you sent me this record months and months and months ago.
Yep. It's totally cool. Cause I trust you and respect your opinion.
And I, from the moment I heard When Life Was Hard, I just got like goosebumps. I'm like, oh man, this
Thank
is
you.
So, and I told my, you know, my wife's the only one I told. I go, you know that guy, Ricky Warwick? And she goes, no. And then I said, then I have to explain because she doesn't listen to what I say, Ricky. And then I go, he sent me his new album. It doesn't come out till February. She was like, that's really cool. And so I've been listening to this thing for months,
yeah,
and I've just been, I just kept waiting. Like, when is this going to be released? When is he going to announce it so that I can start getting excited about it?
I've been sitting on it for 2 years and it's been killing me.
I can imagine. It's
been killing me, you know, because we didn't change anything due to the pandemic, Pat. It was always going to come out in February of 2021,
okay,
because obviously last year we were going to be touring with Black Star Riders. So the pandemic didn't shift the dates or the release schedule. It's just the way it works out because we have to plan when Black Star Riders, you know, and it's been killing me, you know, and I just can't wait for people to hear it. And just sort of harking back and just thinking about the lyrics that Sam said, there's a line in when Life Was Hard and Fast that just sums me up better than I could ever sum myself up. And Sam wrote, the line is, so how are you going to keep me working on this farm? Cause I grew up on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
When I can see the road ahead, it's tattooed on my arm. And I was just like,
poetry,
you bastard.
Yeah.
You know, how dare you be that fucking good, you know? And that was my life, because I was working on a farm. I left school at 15. I went home to work on the farm. I hated it. I didn't hate it. I hated some aspects of it. Some aspects of it I actually quite liked. But I was always dreaming. I was always dreaming of the road ahead and being able to play music full time.
Cool.
It consumed me, as it still does.
Well,
you know?
This is as always. Every one of your albums kicks off with an amazing opening track, and I mean, it kind of has
Thank
to.
You.
Because you want to keep people listening.
Yeah, you got to get them in, right?
Yeah.
And you got to get them in the store.
As you're telling me about you growing up as a kid and working on a farm, when my daughter, who's 16, tells me that she's bored and tired of being in the house during this pandemic, I just tell her, I go, you don't even know what this would be like if it was when I grew up or when you grew up, I go, because our whole life was being outside and playing. We didn't have all this technology. There wasn't nonstop television shows 24/7. And I don't know if you're feeling any of that or hearing any of that at home.
I grew up on a farm. It was a very small farm. We were very poor. We didn't have a lot of money. My dad loved farming. My dad was not a great businessman, but he was an amazing farmer. He worked 365 a year, sun up, sun down, just passionate.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me from that blue collar working class thing. I'm very blessed in that I live in Beverly Hills in a nice place. The sun's always shining. Life is easy here. And my kids still complain.
It's tough.
And when I think about what, you know, my kids complain about walking three blocks to school in 75 degrees sunshine.
It's unbelievable.
When, you know, I would have to get a bus and then walk a mile in snow and sleet and rain or wind. And then I'd have to come home and do whatever homework I had and then go straight out onto the farm. You know, I had to get up at 6:30 and feed animals and muck out shit before I'd go to school.
Yeah.
And then I was playing soccer on a Saturday or, you know, Sunday. I was maybe playing rugby or doing, you know, it was just, you know, and now I kind of get them to wash a dish without, oh, God.
No, I know, it's crazy. Make me some food.
And then I start on them and I sound like that old guy going, well, back in my day.
Right,
and
exactly.
Kind of go, you know, how do you know, it's so, look, I think we're all relative to the situations that we find ourselves in.
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's tough being a kid today for completely different reasons than it was tough being a kid when we were kids.
Right.
I feel sorry for them. The social media thing is so necessary and it's overtaken their whole lives. And there's so much cyberbullying. And we've had, you know, sadly, my kids, there's been stuff going on where we've had to, I'm sure we all have, you know, it's just, it's out of control.
Yeah.
And because the access is there, the attention span is gone. They don't read books anymore. They don't listen the full way through to a song. My daughter will get in the car with me and we'll drive a mile to go to get Starbucks and she'll have listened to 75 songs in that 1 mile, you know, 10 seconds of each song. I said, what about listening to the whole fucking song?
Right.
Well, this is the bit, of, you know, it's... Ugh.
Yeah,
anyway.
I'm trying to get my daughter to listen to a whole album. I'm like, even if it's stuff that she likes, I'm like, hey, that new Taylor Swift album's out. Let's listen to it. She's like, well, play me a couple songs. I'm like, no, you listen to the whole thing. But all right. Well, we're going through the same thing.
Well, I mean, my daughter, we got her into vinyl. She got a record player for Christmas, which I'm very proud of.
My daughter got a record player for Christmas too. I just set it up finally yesterday. So
there's hope.
All right. Track two. You Don't Love Me. This is definitely not a love song.
No, not at all. It's a kind of, you don't love me, I don't care type kind of song.
Mm-hmm.
You don't love me anymore. You don't want me, that's for sure. I saw it coming a long, long time ago. You don't want me, you don't love me. It's alright, it's alright. Nobody's bathing your tears tonight. It's alright, it's alright. Well, actions contradict your words, don't mean anything. You don't love me. You don't love me.
I think it's really a direct attack at the naysayers, the people that have doubted me or doubted my credentials or want to attack me without even knowing me.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, throughout my career, I've been in situations like that. Obviously, there's a lot of people have been very vocal about me being in Thin Lizzy. And I think it's really sort of saying, you don't know me.
Right.
You know, you don't know me. You know my integrity. You don't you know, you're not even trying to know me. You're not. So I think it's really just saying, I think it's, you know, when actions contradict your words don't mean anything, you know, it's like, it's just words.
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life? Why are you going on social media and spouting hate? Like, if I don't like something, I'm not going to go on and go, I really hate your song and I really hate you and right. You're a dick and blah. I don't like it. I'm not going to go and rag on a person.
Yeah. That's amazing.
There's better things to do with my energy, you know?
Yeah. I'm amazed that the people that will take the time to write something negative and send it to you. I wonder if they take the same time to write something positive and send it to people also.
They don't. Because sadly, those people, they get a kick out of being negative. The insecurities that they have by putting it on somebody else, it makes them feel good about themselves. I get hate. Like, everybody that's in a band or makes music or creates art, I get shit every day from people. I get amazing stuff every day that fills me with joy and happiness and validates everything that I'm doing. And it obviously, thankfully, far outweighs. But I get stuff every day. You know, you suck. You know, you're blah, blah, blah.
I get it too, just from doing this show.
Sure. Of course you do.
So, you know, but I get, like you, I get tons of, you know, the positive outweighs the negative. But when you open up one of those negative ones and you're like, really? You took the time to do this?
Yeah, and that's what gets me. You took the time to be negative and to be nasty. And you know, when you could have said nothing and taken that energy and trying to find some positivity with it and what have you. So anyway, I mean, it's the whole thing is, you don't love me. I don't really care. You don't own me. You don't know me. You know, you don't really know anything about me. And that's really where it's coming from.
Gotcha.
You know,
and we have a solo on this album is played by who?
Luke Morley from Thunder, who a lot of the US viewers may not be too aware of Thunder. I think they're a bit like the Almighty and they'd some limited sort of cult success in the States, my old band, the Almighty, but massive in the UK,
yes.
Like an arena band in the UK for many years. And Luke's been a very good friend of mine for over 30 years. Wonderful songwriter and wonderful guitar player. Luke actually is an honorary member of Black Star Riders back in 2018, just after Damon Johnson left. Christian Martucci, who's the guitar player of Black Star Riders now, was still touring with Stone Sour, and we had a tour of South America scheduled, and Damon had left and didn't want to do the South American tour. Christian wasn't available yet, and Luke came in and actually did the tour and was phenomenal. And I was working on the solo record at the time, and I was like, you know, we've known each other for 30 years and you've never played on one of my albums. I said, that's going to change me. I want you to play a solo. And he's like, send it over. And his solo.
It's great. It's fantastic.
Me. Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. Thunder has a new album coming out this year, I think in the next,
which is amazing.
Next couple months. So, US get on the Thunder train. Cause they are great. I think the only thing that we, MTV played Dirty Love when that came out. And that's 30 some years ago now. And they have, they have so many albums. So get on the Thunder train, people.
The new album is fantastic. Luke sent me it a while ago and it really is. The songs are amazing on it. Really great, really great stuff.
All right. Next song coming up is I'd Rather Be Hit. And the lyric in this is killer. I even read this one to my wife.
Thank you.
I'd rather be hit by any man than hurt by any woman. And I got to tell you that's true. That's true.
Yeah,
I don't know any man that would deny that. You can resurrect the past and try to make it last. The future's coming fast. The forbidden fruit of time is slowly rotting minds in all forgotten towns.
Tired of hanging on, waiting around. it's a metaphor, obviously, for a lot of things, and it's very much used in a metaphorical sense. It could almost be a country title. It's you know, a country song title. It's got that vibe to it. You know, I think the next line is, "I'd rather sell my soul for a piece of hope than give my heart away for nothing."
Yeah,
and that's sort of, you know, that's sort of saying, you know, yeah, you know, stick to your ideals. You know, the song is a little bit political, and it was written. The idea for it was written just after Trump got inaugurated 4 years ago, and I feared for humanity, and I think that was it, you know. And I think I'm just trying to remember some more of the lyrics, you know. It's about staying strong and being positive, and like you said, you'd rather be hit by a man. Sometimes when you're scorned or mentally scarred, it's sometimes worse than being physically scarred.
Yeah,
and I think that's really what it's about.
Physical scar will probably heal quicker.
It will heal. Yeah. You know. Yeah, staying strong in there, I think, really is a message behind that, you know.
And then we have an amazing solo on this song too. I love that you're calling in the favors from your friends,
right?
Who plays the solo on this song? Tell us. I know, but tell the people.
Andy Taylor of Duran Duran and the Power Station plays the solo on "I'd Rather Be Hit." Again, known Andy for a long time. Andy produced an Almighty album way back in the early 90s, and we've been friends ever since. And Andy briefly came back to Duran Duran in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Left again, and then kind of went to ground. He lives in Ibiza, an island just off Spain. And he has kids, and he took some time out to raise his kids and, you know, enjoy being Andy Taylor. And I got a phone call from him in 2017 saying he was working on some new stuff. And he flew me out to Ibiza, and we wrote a bunch of songs together. Six of them, which are going to end up on his new record, which is coming out later this year, which
excellent.
Is phenomenal. Brilliant album. Andy's a great producer. He's a great singer. He's a great guitar player. He's a, you know, people think, oh, he's in Duran Duran. No, the guy's a dyed-in-the-wool rock and roller. The guy was 15 years old, playing army bases all over Europe. You know, his favorite band's AC/DC. He's the real deal. And so, you know, again, I was like, dude, I helped you out in yours. Come on, play some guitar in mine. And of course he did. And again, just amazing.
Again, this is another great song. And it's so fun to hear that Andy Taylor is going to have new music out, because his first solo album, Thunder, I still play it. It is so good. And I loved when the album that he made with Rod Stewart, I think it was Out of Order. That album's killer. And I get excited when I hear that Andy Taylor's going to do anything. So
me too.
He's
awesome.
He's kind of a mystery man.
Yeah.
Next song is a cover.
Yes.
It's a Willie DeVille song called Gunslinger. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3. How, what's your process when you go about choosing to record a song that you didn't write?
This is a Willie DeVille song that he put out under his guys, a.k.a. Mink DeVille.
Mink DeVille.
And it was the B-side of a single. The A-side was a song called Spanish Stroll, which came out, I think, 77, 78, was his biggest hit. And I remember him as a kid on Top of the Pops in the U.K. doing that song. He was like a more sophisticated Johnny Thunders in the way that he looked and dressed.
Yeah.
He had that real New York Italian going on, you know, great suits and the shoes and the little tash and everything, slick back hair. I thought he was awesome. And very underrated songwriter as well. And I bought the single. And as you do when we were kids, you flip it over. And 50% of the time, as you remember, Pat, the B-sides better than the A side. And the B side of that song was Gunslinger. And I'm like, this is, I just loved it. I just loved the guitars on it. I mean, there's like three chords in it, as all the best songs are. And I learned to sort of play guitar along with it. And I remember, you know, thinking sporadically through the years, I gotta record Gunslinger. It's one of my favorite songs ever. And I keep forgetting that I love it. And I keep forgetting it's there. And then a few years ago, I tracked down a Mink DeVille album on vinyl. And of course, you know, suddenly it reignited all those memories, right, like back listening. I thought, oh yeah, Gunslinger. I need to record that song. So that was, it just tied in. I was in with Keith and I went, I want to do a cover. And I played him Gunslinger, which I don't think he'd heard. And he's blown away. And we did it. It's just such a great song. I can't wait to play that one live.
And was Gunslinger, was it a non-LP B-side or was it on the album also?
I've got a best of, is the vinyl that I was able to get of. So I'm not sure if it's ever appeared on an actual album.
Gotcha.
It may well do. I don't know. I need to go and check.
All right. Well, a great cover. I don't know the original, but I'm going to seek it out now because I want to see how it compares to what you guys did.
We stayed pretty true to the original arrangement wise and delivery wise. It's a bit heavier, mm-hmm. you know, in how we've attacked it. Just because of the nature of what it is and you know, finesse. I'm not known for my finesse. So it's definitely a bit heavier than the original.
Well, when you cover a deep album track that no one is super familiar with, it's much different from if you cover a Beatles song. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You're just introducing this song to a whole new world of people.
Yeah. I mean, because it was an influence on me and his music is an influence and it fits in with my repertoire. You know, it sits in there. You know, if you didn't, you know, with all humility, if somebody didn't tell you that was a cover version, you would just think that's a Ricky Warwick song on that album,
right,
because it doesn't jump out or doesn't go, oh, that's, like,
no,
you said, that's a Beatles song. Or
no, it fits right in.
It has to me, it had to work within the sort of phonetics of the album, you know?
Cool. Yeah, it's great. And you're right. It's feels like a Ricky Warwick song. It goes right in with the theme and the themes of this album. So perfect. Never Corner a Rat. Now, when I listen to this one, this is a hard driving song from the jump.
Yeah.
Just by reading the title, I thought Never Corner a Rat. It made me conjured up like a gangster images, like that kid's a rat. What's the real story behind it?
Real story is talking to a veteran who'd done a few tours in Iraq and having a conversation with him. I met him, came to Black Star Rider show and was just talking to him. And he was just talking about how he felt he'd been let down by his country after he came home and wasn't given the help, because this poor guy had definitely post-traumatic stress syndrome and was obviously a lot of demons in there and I was just struggling with normal life.
Yeah.
And it was a great conversation with him. I found the guy fascinating, and he just said this great thing. He just said, you know, never corner Iraq, because they'll always bite back. And I just thought, oh, that's killer, you know?
Yeah.
So it's more me lifting what he said to me about his experiences and creating a theme and a story around that, you know, a little bit of poetic license, you know, adding to it. But it was just such a great story. And you know, a sad one as well, but he was quite defiant that he wouldn't let it beat him. And I thought that was the Never Corner a Rat thing, you know?
That's good. For most of my life, I always thought that if you served in the military, when you came home, you were taken care of for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
I always thought that's, I always thought that's how it was. And learning that that's not the case, and learning it so late in life, like when I should have known, but didn't, is kind of sad.
I was the same. I was the same. It was actually, you know, a lot of it was, you know, Sam Robinson, who we're talking about. Sam's one of Sam's boys served in the British Army and went to Iraq. And there's a song called Before the War on the first Black Star Riders album.
Yeah.
And that was written, you know, inspired by Sam's. Just dealing with what they see over there and the situations that they're put in. And suddenly they're back. You're back home now. Woof, pushed out. There you go. Hang on a minute. I'm still having nightmares. Hang on a minute. I'm still ducking every time I hear a car backfire. I you know, I'm struggling trying to find a job. I'm drinking, you know, that's sometimes the real war that these guys are fighting, you know, it's the one up there when they come home, you know, and I just feel for them, you know, they deserve better.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know when it gets better. I mean, we all know these stories, but no one seems to do anything. It's just like when I see homeless people, I mean, you know, I'll give them a couple bucks, but I know that's not doing anything.
Sure.
It's hard.
Sure. Of course it is. It is. It's sad.
All right. Track six. I'm assuming that this might be the most personal song on the album for you. Time Don't Seem to Matter.
Yes. The song, I wrote this song in Belfast. What we tend to do is when we're doing the European festival circuit, obviously during the week, there's days when it's not festivals on and it's too far to fly back to California. So what I would do was for those days, I'll go back to Ireland or to Scotland and stay with family. I was back in Belfast staying at my cousin's house and she was out of work. And I was really missing being away from family. I'd been out about 4 weeks at this point. And I just picked the guitar up and just wrote how I felt at that point in time. Just, this is how I feel right now. But it's going to be okay because when I come home, I'm going to be home for 6 weeks and I'm going to get to spend every day with you uninterrupted. And if we want to go to the movies, we can go to the movies 20 times a day, you know, and that, you know, so not the quantity of time, but the quality. I wrote it really predominantly for my youngest daughter, Pepper, because she's always known her dad as a touring musician since she was born. That's all I've done. Dad's always going away. Yeah. Dad's coming home. Dad's going away. And I've missed probably, she's 13 now, I've probably missed 7 of her birthdays where I've not been there, or high school stuff. And that's the one downside about what we do.
Yeah.
You know, what we do is a great job. We're blessed. It's easy. I got nothing to complain about except that bit. And that's just part of it. So really written for her. And I came back, I played it to Keith. And Keith said, it's great. Let's demo it. And I said, can we do it another day? I said, I've got a really bad cold. I had a really stinking cold that day. And he said, no, we just put it down. No, it doesn't matter if you can't sing it. Let's just get the idea down and get the song down and stuff like that. So I demoed it. And my voice, if you listen to it now, my voice cracks a couple of times when I'm singing it. But it's kind of in a cool way. And it's due to the fact that I was completely clogged up with a cold. So it's demoed. We go to record the album. We come to recut this song, Time Don't Seem to Matter, and set up the acoustic guitar. And I can't recreate it because I don't have a cold.
Yeah.
So I don't get, I'm not capturing the same vibe or the same feeling that I captured that day we put the demo down. And we spent an afternoon trying to mess about with it. And that demo was done on one take. It's me playing a guitar and singing live. Keith just said, just use the demo. We'll add the strings. We'll use the demo. We kept the demo, added the strings. And I said, you know what? I said, Pepper, my daughter, is really getting into music. She's singing every day. She's learning guitar. She's learning violin. You know, it'd be really cool if I get her in to sing on it. And Keith thought it was a great idea because he's a dad himself. So we got her in and she was, I mean, you know, kids, as you know yourself, they're still just like, okay, whatever.
Right.
And she comes in and she sings it in two takes. And, okay, can we go get something to eat? Can we go to Starbucks? Can we, you know? And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. This is, you know, I'm the proud dad, best day of my life. And, you know, she's just totally, yeah, whatever, dad, you know. And she was 11 when she sang on that, when we recorded. She's 11. She's 13 now. So she's even more embarrassed about it now than she was when she was 11.
So at 11, the lyrics didn't really, they didn't bring up any emotion in her. She just, you know what I'm saying?
She's quite an emotional little person. Mm-hmm. I think if it did, she wasn't showing it because she's at that age now where, oh my God, my parents are so embarrassing that we all went through. She's definitely at that age at the minute. And, you know, as we know, it's they don't really mean it.
Right.
So I'm way more excited about it than she is, and the funny thing is like, I'm obviously doing a lot of promo for the record. I said, everybody's asking about the song you sang on. She's like, oh God, oh really? What are you saying? What are you telling them about me? And her friends think it's great. Friends think it's amazing.
Right. Of course they do.
But she's, you know, and she's 13. She's working it all out in the world, hating things and being a rebel and everything that a 13-year-old should be, you know. But it was definitely, it was a real moment that hit home. I remember some of those moments thinking, here I am in Los Angeles, in my 50s, with my little girl that was born here, making a record, sun is shining. Wow.
Time don't seem to matter when I'm alone with you. There's nowhere else I'd rather be. This is all I wanna do. If wishes were like horses, then beggars they would ride. If distance wasn't measured, I'd always be by your side. We're all searching for the answers. There won't be in any book. I know where to find you. You're always in the last place that I look.
You know, it's great. In 4 more years, she's going to be so proud of this song and she's going to be telling her friends about it. Because that's how they change.
It is how they change, you know. Because I've obviously got 2 other daughters that are growing up, and so we've been through it. I know what's coming. It's almost playing out by the book now, you know. But she's still really into music, and it's great. And what I do, I do 2 things as I've got older. I wear contact lenses, and obviously I take them out at night. So strategically, I put a pair of glasses in each room in the house because you're always losing your glasses, as you know yourself.
Yeah,
right?
I got them on right now.
I do the same thing with acoustic guitars. I have acoustic guitar in every room of the house because you never know when inspiration is going to hit. And they're like, oh, where's my guitar? It's in the case. Blah, 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 blah. 3 of my guitars are now in her room.
There you go.
You know, yeah. I go, where's that? Pepper. And it's great. So,
but you're so excited that it's in her room at the same time.
Of course I am.
You're bummed that it's not in your room, but you're excited where it is.
Kids never put anything back, so I'm kind of, like you said, I kind of want to tell her off, but I'm kind of secretly very, very proud and happy she's being creative, you know.
Well, it's a really great song, and I know she doesn't want to hear
but
you can tell her that I love it too.
Oh, thank you. I will.
All right, Fighting Heart, written with Keith Nelson. This is the one that sounds like Black Star Riders to me.
Right. Okay.
I mean, that's just to my ears.
Got your name tattooed on my chest. Well, I was never blessed with common sense. All that blood ink and no regrets. Well, hey, you're no angel yourself. We'll be right back.
It's funny you say that. I mean, Keith is a big Lizzy fan. I mean, aren't we all? So he was very influential in keeping a lot of the dual lead thing going, which I love and always have loved. So I was all about that. Keith did a lot of work in this song. I had the chords and the idea, and I think that the chorus may have been the verse when I brought it. I'm trying to remember.
Okay.
And Keith was like, "What are you doing? You know, your verse is your chorus." And I went, you know, I was like, "No, it's not. It's the verse." And he was like, "No, that's the money line. That's the chorus right there."
That's interesting.
And so we switched it, and then I went away and rewrote the lyrics for the verse, and we rebuilt the song from that. But in saying that, that's the first song we worked on together. The very first song we worked on together, and the song that inspired me to go back to Keith, because we actually started off writing it for somebody else. We were going to write a song.
Okay.
And I think the idea was we were going to write it for somebody else at the time. And when we'd finished it and I had the demo, then I went back to Keith and went, "Hey, you know, let's do an album. Let's do a whole album." And of course he agreed, obviously. And so that was really the catalyst for starting off the whole album.
I don't know how you would write a song for someone else and then when you're done, not want to keep it all the time, unless you really wrote it, unless it's so specific for that person and it's a song that you would never do yourself.
Sure. I mean, it is. I mean, having written for other people, obviously written for Andy and written for bands like the Amorettes, and I've just co-written a song with a punk band called Down by Law. It's coming out in their new album. But usually you have that in mind that it turns into something else when you're writing it. And it's like you have to, with that one, as we were writing it, more we were writing it, it suddenly became a Ricky Warwick song.
Okay.
I'm kind of going, this isn't for anybody else. I'm going to sing this. I'm not giving this to anybody else. And that happens. That's happened a lot. There's a lot of stuff I've written for other people or ideas that I've had where I get into it and I went, they're not getting this.
No.
A perfect example I'll give you, Pat, is Testifier Say Goodbye, one of Black Star Rider's biggest hits.
So great.
Massive hit in the UK. I wrote that for another band and sent it to them. And they kind of dragged their heels on it a little bit. And I was playing it one day in the dressing room at Black Star Rider's gig, and Jimmy DeGrasso was our drummer at the time. And Jimmy goes, "What's that?" I goes, "That's a song called Testifier Say Goodbye. I wrote it for blah, 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 blah."
Yeah.
He said, "You better call him up and get that song back." So I got to get Jimmy kudos. And I did, you know, and I remember being called. I said, "Yeah, you know," then they were dragging their heels. And, you know, of course we get it back. We record it and it's single a week at BBC Radio 2 and the whole thing. So lucky escape, but I got Jimmy. But that happens, you know.
And then they were probably bummed that they dragged their heels on it.
Probably, yeah. But they got another couple of songs out of me, so it was
all right.
Okay.
Well, that's good. Next song, "I Don't Feel at Home." This is about drug addiction.
Yeah, yeah. And the last song written for the record.
Heroin tears, she cried on it. They roll out her face and they burn like fire. The room is cold and empty and uninspired. Trying to hold the rain. Everything is so pointless and all in vain.
is this a personal thing with you? Have you had any struggles with drug addiction?
I've certainly had struggles over the years with drug addiction, not to the point where I've had to go into rehab or anything like that. I'm lucky that I'm quite good at checking myself. There was certainly a period of time when I was doing it way too much and I shouldn't have been. And my life suffered incredibly for it. And I went, you know, I was hanging about with the wrong people, doing the wrong stuff and making the wrong decisions. It was all me. I was the one that was doing it. It was nobody else's fault, but I was certainly at that point where I'm trying to blame everybody else.
And was this
that was a dark period of my life. That was around about 1999, 2000.
Okay.
Right before I started doing the solo stuff. Very disillusioned with a lot of things and just bitter and, you know, just in a rut, you know, nasty divorce. A lot of things weren't going my way and I reacted badly to it. But this song's written, it was the last song we wrote for the record. And Keith and I actually wrote it in the studio. We felt we needed it. Mm-hmm. We felt we needed a song with that vibe, that sort of almost Southern rock groove to it musically. And I have a family member that sadly that suffered with drug addiction their whole adult life. And it was written for them. And it was written about them, but it was almost written with a little bit of a wider scope as well, that it could be about anybody that's going through that. But I based it on what I've seen my relative go through for the last 25 years.
And has that relative made it through?
He struggles with it every day.
Still.
And he, you know, doing pretty good right now. But that's been the case their whole adult life. Good for a while, you know. It's been tough, and it's been very tough on everybody that's been around them, because it just, as you know, that doesn't affect the person that's having the addiction problems. It affects everybody that's involved with that person and makes life extremely hard and uncomfortable. And, you know, it was a cry for help and, you know, I don't feel at home in this world anymore. You know, I think that was it. It's just the not fitting in, the numbing of the pain, the disillusionment, the feeling the whole world's against you, afraid to ask for help, all that stuff.
I like your songwriting because, you know, rock and roll can be looked at as just frivolous sometimes, but you always dig deep with lyrics and things that you want to convey. So that's cool.
Thank you. It's therapy for me, Pat. I mean, it really is. It's my diary. It's the way for me to deal with my own demons and my own inner thoughts. I'm not very great. I express myself better when I'm writing lyrics than I do in any other sort of form. And it really is. It's total therapy for me.
What's great is some people don't even have that outlet. So at least you know that you have this to get out these emotions. And also, just from knowing you, you've never seemed like a drug guy to me. You've always seemed like a have a couple beers after a show type of a guy.
I wanted to ask that because
I felt like, you know, this was about drug addiction.
I partied pretty hard and you know, up until 15, 16 years ago, I would still party quite hard on occasion, but I'm one of the lucky ones. I don't have an addictive personality and I never let it affect my work. I knew if I had to be somewhere or something to do the next day, then it wouldn't. I was one of these guys where I would go crazy for a couple of months. I mean, crazy, you know, really, really crazy. And then not touch anything for 6 months. Nothing. I've never smoked in my life ever.
Me neither.
I'm the same. Well, you know, I've smoked tons of marijuana.
I've never even done that.
I've probably taken every other drug available that's out there, but I've never smoked cigarettes. I mean, I would be sitting in the back of a tour bus and out of my mind on coke or speed or something like that, and somebody passed a cigarette. I'm like, no, I'm not taking those things. Will kill you. You know, after sticking who knows what up my nose, you know, and I don't know why that is, you know. I'm very sort of clean living now, and have been for quite some time. I like the old Guinness, like the old whiskey now and again. That's about it.
That's good.
That's good. Really, you know,
that's partying's for the young.
It is. You know, I want to keep doing this for eons, you know, so I want to look after myself.
Yeah.
And I feel good. You know, it's all about feeling good. I mean, I feel better. People, you know, it's very rock and roll, you don't drink. I said, well, I drink, I feel like shit the next day.
Right.
I feel like shit for the next 2 days. I'm fucking paranoid. I've got high anxiety. I'm you know, I look, makes me look, when I don't drink, when I don't do, I said, I feel great and I'm more creative, you know?
Yeah. Sadly, the older you get, you can't handle that stuff anymore. You just can't.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you have some help on this. You have a guest on keyboards on this song too.
Mr. Dizzy Reed. Yes, indeed.
From Guns N' Roses.
Again, Dizzy's known Dizzy for years, you know, Dizzy's great. We've had the honor we did some shows with Guns N' Roses with Thin Lizzy back in 2012 in the UK, which was amazing. And Dizzy's just a great mate. Now, this was cool because Dizzy could come into the studio because he's here in LA.
Yeah.
So Dizzy came in and actually played in the studio with us, which was very cool.
Excellent. Moving on to track 9, we got Still Alive. This one reminds me of Thin Lizzy just because of it immediately starts with a couple of characters. Billy Joe and Jimmy Brown. And that's stuff like that just always reminds me of the way Phil would write.
Billy Joe and Jimmy Brown struck out one night and lit up the town. On the making, on the lash, like a bullet from their past. Billy swore while Jimmy prayed, Jesus wept while Mary played. With a taste for a little more,
it's that poetic license thing. It's like, I think the song was inspired by the movie Hell or High Water. I think I'd watched that and thought that was great about the two bank robbers down in Texas, modern day bank robbers.
Great movie.
And I just thought a great story, and I just thought a bit of poetic license. So vicariously wanted to be the outlaw because I love Westerns and old Westerns. I just always have. And just taking that and conjuring up this idea of, I love road trips. I love, you know, just being on the run. You know, I've been on the run my whole life. I don't know what the fuck I'm running from, but I feel like I'm, you know, I've been running my whole life, and that appeals to me. And I just put that, you know, and sort of metamorphized it into more than it was, and create these characters and create this story. And Keith is a great slide guitar player. Keith Nelson's a great slide guitar player. And, I had to let him loose on and that was the song to do it. And you know, I play him some Rose Tattoo. I said, play like Pete Wells from Rose Tattoo. He said, yeah, no problem, you know. So
see, Rose Tattoo, another band that is lost on the US, but another great band.
Amazing, yeah. Yeah. I mean, people will probably know it from Guns N' Roses covering, you know, Nice Boys.
Right.
Don't Play Rock and Roll, which is a Rose Tattoo song. An Australian institution.
Yeah.
And a great band.
When you finally get to go on the road, whether it's solo or with Black Star Riders, and you have to leave home after being, you know, in lockdown for this long and being so close with your family, it's probably going to be more emotional than any other time you've went on tour, I would think.
We were just talking about that the other day. My wife and Pepper, we were in the car, and I was sort of saying, you know, I haven't played a show now in almost 15 months, and it's probably going to be another 8 or 9 months before I play a show.
Yeah, realistically. I think a lot of people aren't being realistic. Like, I go on bands' websites and they have like shows booked for April. I'm like, those aren't going to happen. Come on, guys.
No.
So
no, they're not. You know, it's just, you know, I have some shows booked in the UK for April and May, which I booked a while ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, they ain't going to happen. Mm-mm. They're just not. It's just, you know, and I'll move them, and that's just the way it is. But I think that people just think we're going to get the vaccine and you just click a switch and everything will be back to normal.
Yeah.
It's going to be slow. We'll get there, but it's going to be slow.
Yeah.
And I've accepted that. You know, I'm not pissed off about it. It just is what it is. And I want it to be like we all do. I want to play in a safe environment. So if it takes 8-9 months a year, that's what it takes.
And I don't even know when a guy like you and I will get the vaccine, because we're at that age where we're not so old, you know, and where it's in good health. So, you know, we might not get a vaccine for a while, you and I.
Well, that's it, you know, and again, who knows if you're going to need, you might need that to travel. You might need that to go, you know, who knows?
Yeah. So, and again, I'll just
roll with it. And when we're good, I'll be ready to go. But yeah, it's going to be weird leaving. I've been home, you know, I've never been home this long in my life before. My adult life, you know, and it's been amazing. It's been really, really good. I've really enjoyed it. So it's going to be tough to walk out the door and head off for six weeks, you know.
When we were talking earlier about time don't seem to matter, and you were saying about you were away for a month. Again, what kids don't realize is this type of thing, FaceTime and Zoom. And mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. even if this was back when we were kids, the kids literally wouldn't see their dad when he was on tour at all.
Exactly.
And,
no.
And it wasn't.
No, I mean, I remember touring back then. This is before I had kids, but I remember, you know, calling girlfriends or my mom and being in Germany before the euro was in and trying to find a pay phone, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning and some gas station and, you know, in Dusseldorf and putting the Pfennigs and the German money and, you know, the Deutschmarks in there and, you know, you get like 30s. I'm okay. Everybody will go, bye. You know?
Yeah. Now you pick it up and it's right there in your pocket all the time. So it's not the same as being there, but it's a lot better. Track 10, Clown of Misery. Now this is recorded very lo-fi. I'm assuming this is a demo. I never thought Time Don't Seem to Matter was a demo, but I definitely felt like this one was a demo.
This is a joke that this is the cheapest song that I'll ever record. It's from the iPhone. It's me singing the song into the iPhone, sending it to Keith. Keith going, there's a desperation in this that I really like. Let's make it sound like an old Woody Guthrie, Hank Williams song.
I'm just a clown of misery. Everyone laughs at me. I'm not trying to be funny, but I still make them all smile. I'm a sailor lost at sea, no one to rescue me. They all cheer and applaud as my ship goes down. I'm a vagabond dreaming, drifter, a fool. I'm not waving, I'm drowning. What does it take to get through? Just a clown of misery. Everyone laughs at me. I'm
not trying to be funny. Just taking that iPhone and distorting it, almost making it sound mono. That old crackly, you know, 78 record sound from back in the day. And that's it. But the actual, you know, the whole thing is just me. It's the iPhone. Simple as that. Because the song is a certain desperation about it. And I think the way it's portrayed and recorded, to put any gloss on it would take away from the desperation that's already there.
And the lyric, I'm not waving, I'm drowning, just is a gut. Yeah. It's a gut punch.
Yeah, you know, it's the whole thing. I think it's the performer's curse that, you know, if you have a shitty day or things aren't going away or you've been in an argument with somebody, you still have to get up on that stage and you still have to put on a show and entertain people because that's what they paid to come and see. So it's like, you know, out front, you're giving it all. Inside, you could be dying or falling apart and you can't let that show.
No.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're coming to the end. Track 11, You're My Rock and Roll. And this one starts with, is this a real phone call to Keith Nelson? Is this something you guys?
No, we staged it for, you know, Rock and Roll Liberty. That's what it is. We did it in the studio. We staged it. I mean, a celebration of rock and roll, simple as that, of a love for rock and roll. It's got that real glam 70s drum shuffle. Glam rock shuffle going on in the drums, big anthemic chorus, you know, rock and roll never lets you down. And it's sort of saying, you know, you've never let me down. Don't ever start letting me down. It's just singing about the joy of music and the joy of life, the joy of living, the joy of playing music, listening to music,
seeing it. It's a perfect album closer because all those things you just said, And when you get to the end of this album, that's how you feel. So bravo. Good job.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Oh man. Thanks a million. Thank you, Pat.
All right, Ricky, that's it. So let's do some promoting for this thing. I know we got through the whole thing.
thank you.
When Life Was Hard and Fast comes out February 19th.
Nuclear Blast.
And you can pre-order it everywhere right now. And again, vinyl,
yeah, you know,
CDs.
All these are places that you can go to RickyWarwick.com. There's links on there where you can pre-order.
And Ricky's out there on Twitter, at Ricky Warwick. And Instagram is Ricky Warwick Official. And again,
correct,
like you said, website, RickyWarwick.com. And when I brought up the tour dates that people had booked, I didn't mean you specifically,
because
when you said,
no, I know,
but yeah, I'm just, it's just, I do think it's going to be a lot longer before we have live shows and stuff. So,
you know, and we all wanted to be safe. I mean, who really wants to go to a high intensity rock and roll show and make sure you're standing 6 feet away from the guy next to you?
Be concerned about yourself, because you're going to, in the end, you're going to be like, well, if I got sick, this wouldn't be worth it. Would be worth it if you got sick.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's be safe, you know, let's be sensible and let's be safe, you know?
Exactly. Ricky, you're always a solid.
Two words that should never go in rock and roll.
No,
sensible and safe.
Ricky, I always enjoy when you're on the show. You're a solid dude in person.
Thank you.
And I can't believe I said the word dude, but you make music that I love. And I love that you are continuing to fly the rock and roll flag. You know,
it's
rock and roll. And I love it. So I appreciate it. So I want everyone to go buy this album. So Ricky, thanks so much. And oh, you know what?
Absolute honor.
I always end with a playout song. Which one of the tracks would you like me to use as the playout song today?
Oh, let's go with You're My Rock and Roll.
All right. It ends the album. So it's going to end the show. Here it is.
Yep.
You're My Rock and Roll. Thanks, Ricky.
Thanks, Pat.
Hey, Keith, it's Ricky.
Hey, man.
Hey, bro, I just wanted to say, we've come a long way since Jerry Lee's. Rock and roll ain't dead. It's just lost. It's missing.